Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Monday, April 13th, 2015. Present today, we have Co-Chair Representative Newman, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Representative Edgemon, Representative Gaddis, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. They interfere with your recording equipment. Today we will hear House Bill 190, SB 26, House Bill 105, and House Bill 154. Additionally, we will have the second hearing on House Bill 123 and hear public testimony. First bill we have up today is House Bill 190, an act relating to a medical assistance referral reform program relating to the duties of the Department of Health and Social Services establishing medical assistance demonstration projects relating to civil penalties for medical assistance fraud, relating to studies by the Department of Health and Social Services relating to cost containment measures for medical assistance and providing for an effective date by House Finance. I'm planning on having this bill introduced today, and we will walk through the sectional. Then we will be putting House Bill 190 aside. Here today to introduce House Bill 190 to the committee is Ms. Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Kelly, and Ms. Jane Pearson, my staff finance assistant. Ms. Shattuck, Ms. Pearson, please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and introduce House Bill 190.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson, and I am going to turn this over to Heather Shattuck.
For the record, my name is Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Kelly and the Senate Finance Committee, and today on loan to the House Finance Committee. House Bill 190 starts the process of cost containment and reform needed to slow the growth of the Alaska Medicaid program. Medicaid has grown to $1.8 billion of the annual operating budget and has accounted for 22% of the total UGF increases over the last 10 years. And those are numbers that we were provided by the Legislative Finance Division. The current and former administrations have testified that the Medicaid program as it stands is not sustainable. Low oil prices and billions of dollars in revenue shortfalls have forced us to change how we do business. In July 2013, the Medicaid Budget Group of the Department of Health and Social Services reported that the total spending on Medicaid services will reach $6.3 billion in 2032, and that includes $2.8 billion in state matching funds. So if we don't act now to bend the growth of Medicaid, many of our most vulnerable Alaskans will be without critical health care services that they need most. And reform is about pushing the right care in the right place at the right time, and you can certainly add for the right price. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to walk through section by section of the bill.
Yes, please do.
Okay, so section one on page one, line seven, is about fraud and civil penalties. This adds a new section establishing civil penalties for false claims for Medicaid and authorizes the Department of Health and Social Services to assess civil penalties against medical assistance providers. And this is really every dollar we divert from fraud is another dollar that's going to serve our most vulnerable. That's a fairly lengthy two-page section, so I'm going to skip to section two, which starts on page three, line five. This puts a Medicaid assistance reform program into statute. Subsection A directs the department to design and implement a program for reforming Medicaid, and the program must include 10 items in this version of HB 190. And I'll just walk through those 10 items and give you a brief explanation of each of those. Number one is it must include referrals to community and social support services, including career and education training services, which are available through the Department of Labor, the university, or others. The state has a lot of training opportunities through our current network of job centers, vocational rehabilitation offices, our Workforce Investment Act programs, vocational training programs, and supports through our extensive nonprofits throughout the state. And as you know, jobs are the path to self-sustaining and an improved self-image, so we certainly want to connect these individuals to as many supports as possible. Number two on line 12 is a distribution of an explanation of benefits to recipients. And we have heard that many other states are providing EOBs to Medicaid recipients. Number three On line 14 is expanding the use of telemedicine for primary care, behavioral health, and urgent care. And I'll focus on expanded telemedicine a little bit later as well. Number 4 is enhanced fraud prevention, detection, and enforcement. A lot has been done under Andrew Peterson and the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Just like Section 1, we want to encourage as much fraud prevention and enforcement as possible. Number 5 is reducing the cost of behavioral health, senior, and disability services provided to recipients of medical assistance under the state's home and community-based services waivers or options. This is where you've heard the Department of Health and Social Services talk about using a 1915K option or a 1915I option, and this section would anticipate the same approach. And those are a way to enhance our current federal match from rates like 50% to 56% for the 1915K option, and it would transition from federal match to 50% match for the 1915I option. And these options could also use telemedicine to check in on folks who are receiving care at home as well. Number 6 is about pharmacy initiatives, and this is definitely expanding on what the department has already done, including using generic medicines, claims pricing and payment reforms, prior authorizations. Number 7 is about enhanced care management. And this could be set up in a couple of different ways. There are methods, these are all about methods to teach the proper use of our healthcare system. And I don't know if any of you intuitively knew how to approach our healthcare system, but I certainly didn't. And I've had to help teach folks who were Medicaid recipients how to go to a primary care doctor, what they need to do. It's pretty overwhelming. So these type of enhanced care management could help that. That could look like primary care case management with the use of a patient-centered medical home. And that can be used in our super utilizer population or others. And this in no way takes away any of our preventative care. This would include preventative care, primary care, vaccines, flu shots, and all other appropriate care. And another example is including special treatment for identified needs, such as pregnancy, diabetes, and asthma. Number 8 on line 22 is about redesigning the payment process, and this would include fee agreements for performance measures that include premium payments for centers of excellence and penalties for hospital-acquired infections, readmissions, and failures of outcomes. We would also anticipate the department would study the use of bundled rates for physicians and diagnosis-related groups for hospitals. So, for example, instead of going to the hospital under the current fee-for-service model and getting charged for an Advil or an IV or every little thing the doctor and the nurses do, there would be one bundled rate, say, for getting a knee replacement. So it's just about streamlining that payment process. And we are one of the only states that is not doing this in our Medicaid program. Number 9 is about stakeholder involvement in setting annual targets for quality and cost effectiveness. And number 10 is about reducing travel costs by requiring a recipient to obtain medical services in the recipient's home community to the extent appropriate when services are available in their home community. So we need to reduce travel where we can, and that's certainly about telemedicine, but it's also about better coordination of travel overall. If you have somebody coming in from the village and a mom has to get some preventative thing that's already scheduled, and she's flying in, say, from Bethel to Anchorage, and then a few weeks later, one of her children has to come in for dental services that are also scheduled. Instead of making two trips where the mom's going to have to fly in with a child anyway, we can consolidate those in one. So that's just one instance of how we can better coordinate travel. Subsection B starts on page 3, line 31, and continues on to the next page. And this has the department identify the areas of the state where improvements in access to telemedicine would be most effective in reducing the cost of Medicaid. This also allows the department to enter into agreements with IHS facilities if necessary to improve access to telemedicine facilities and equipment. As you're probably aware, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has a very excellent and extensive use of telemedicine across the state. They already have that network, so we certainly don't want to reinvent the wheel, and we want to work with them wherever possible. Subsection C on page 4, starting on line 7. This is a report section, and this requires the department to annually report to the legislature on October 15th That date was chosen to help get reports to the legislature before we're in Juneau to allow potential draft legislation, budget considerations, and other options. Some of these things that will be reported are realized cost savings related to reforms in the reform program, savings from reform efforts undertaken by the department, a statement of whether the department has met annual targets for quality and cost effectiveness, and other recommendations for the legislature, including legislative changes that they'd like to see, budget changes, impacts of federal laws, and results of demonstration projects. So we look at this section as basically everything legislators want to know and continue to monitor to reform the Medicaid program. And I suspect this will be very helpful for both finance committees and the Health and Social Services committees in both bodies as we're continuing on this path. And subsection D, which starts on page 5, line 10, just provides a definition for telemedicine. And as we're going through, please, if you have questions, feel free to interrupt. I'd be happy to take them as we're going through. Continuing on with section 3, which is on page 5, line 15, this requires the department to design and implement a demonstration project to reduce non-urgent use of the emergency departments by Medicaid recipients. This would build on what the department has already done with their super utilizer program, and it's about directing individuals to the right care at the right time in the right place. A subsection, in that subsection number 5, on the next page, it's on page 6, lines 1, sets out a process for referring a frequent ER user or super utilizer to a primary care provider within 96 hours after an ER visit. And this program is directed to those folks that are using the ER as their primary care. So we want to make sure they're set up with the appropriate level of health care. And this program would also include strict guidelines for the prescribing of narcotics and a prescription monitoring program. Section 4 on page 6, starting on line 12, this requires the department and the Attorney General to annually prepare a report regarding fraud prevention, abuse, prosecution, and vulnerabilities that exist in the Medicaid program. Section 5 on page 7, starting on line 6, this is a Medicaid managed care or case management demonstration program for individuals enrolled in all of Medicaid. Looking at subsection A, Alaska is one of only about 12 states that does not use some sort of managed health plan in their Medicaid program. Individuals would be managed by traditional insurance carriers like Moda, Aetna, or Premera. And just an added benefit that I like to consider is folks, I imagine, would be getting an insurance card from these insurance carriers. So when they're going to get care, instead of having their Medicaid stickers, they'd be able to turn over an insurance card. So it's just those little things that help people think a little bit differently about themselves. And some folks have run health plans like these. They cite better outcomes and more one-on-one engaged care. This would also include comprehensive care management and care coordination. So, for instance, if you have a woman who is pregnant and enrolled in the Denali Kid Care Program, as soon as she was pregnant, she would be assigned a primary care case manager. And this would be her go-to person. So they would be checking in along the way to make sure the woman is having a healthy pregnancy, to make sure she's taking her prenatal vitamins, getting her questions answered with the same person, and all with the goal of having the healthiest outcomes we can have. And these type of health plans set up relationships and trust between providers and their patients. So if a provider is engaged on this type of level, I would suspect that the recipients are going to be more open and they're going to build that trust, and then the provider might pick up on things that are going wrong with the pregnancy. And they can certainly encourage healthy behavior along the way. And this program would also require individual and family support and referrals to community and social support services, including job training. And again, this is about the whole person, not just immediate health. Subsection B of Section 5 starts down at the bottom of page 7 on line 29. And this requires the department to enter into contracts with one or more third-party administrators for this project. Subsection C on page 8, line 5, outlines the requirements for the department and the third-party administrator for services and fees. And subsection D, this subsection states that it must include cost-saving measures and innovations in the demonstration project. Those would include reducing travel through the expanded use of telemedicine for primary and urgent care and behavioral health. Again, ANTHC has led the way with their telemedicine, and they have done studies that show about 40% of telemedicine visits have avoided travel. And they have the capacity, so we definitely want to interact with them where we can. And this subsection also simplifies the administrative procedures for providers, including streamlining the audit payment and stakeholder engagement procedures. Section 6 on line 20 sets out for feasibility studies. As you are aware, before any state service can be privatized, a feasibility study must be done. This subsection would require us to perform feasibility studies for services delivered at the Alaska Pioneer Homes, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and select facilities of the Division of Juvenile Justice. These studies, and I believe the fiscal note backs this up, they would not look the same for each of these services. For instance, there are private hospitals in the U.S. that all they do is provide psychiatric care. They're doing it at a better rate and getting better outcomes, I would say, than some other facilities. I'd like to highlight that some of the select facilities of DJJ could include Nome, and they actually are not at capacity, and they have a very able tribal partner that's right there in the Norton Sound Health Corporation. And something like this, the facility could be turned over to Norton Sound. They could run it as a residential psychiatric treatment center. So folks, individuals who are juveniles could avoid going to DJJ and go to this RPTC instead, and they'd be getting relevant cultural care, culturally relevant care, close to home, and as a bonus, instead of the state paying 100% GF, it would be a 50% Medicaid match. And just a little statistic, all of these 24/7 facilities represent 1,192 state employees. Section 7 starts on line 30 of page 8. And this section continues on to the next page. It just requires the department to amend the state Medicaid plan and apply for any waivers necessary to implement the projects and programs described in the bill. Section 8 on page 9 allows the department to adopt regulations necessary to implement the changes made by this act. And these regulations may not take effect before the dates are of the relevant provisions in the act takes effect. And the way this is written as transition regulations, this allows the department to start writing the regulations now as they're waiting for approval, but nothing goes into effect until all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed with the federal government. Section 9, starting on page 9, line 16, are the conditional effects. And this protects the department from having to follow a law in the books if the feds don't sign off on our state plan amendments and any waivers needed to implement them. Sections 10 through 14 on page 10 provide for effective dates for provisions that require any waiver in state plan amendment approvals from the United States Department of Health and Social Services. And finally, the last section, 15 on line 22 of page 10, provides an immediate effective dates for sections 6, 7, and 8.
Thank you, Ms. Shattuck and Ms. Pearson, very much. We will have questions from the committee at our next hearing on House Bill 190. Again, thank you. Okay, the next bill we will hear today is SB, Senate Bill 26, an act making and amending appropriations, including capital appropriations, supplemental appropriations, reappropriations, and other appropriations, making appropriations to capitalize funds, making appropriations under Article 9, Section 17C, Constitution of the State of Alaska from the Constitution Budget Reserve Fund, and providing for an effective date, and this is by the Governor. This will also be a brief introduction. Here to introduce the bill to the committee is my staff member, Joe Michelle. Mr. Michelle, please place yourself on the record and give us an overview of Senate Bill 26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Michelle, staff to Representative Steve Thompson in the House Finance Committee. SB 26, in its current form, is spending approximately $113,331,000 of unrestricted general fund dollars, $56,325,000 $1,000,000 of designated general funds, $62,733,000 in other state funds, and $1,275,642,000 in federal receipts.
Say that number again, last one.
The last one is $1,275,642,000 of federal funds.
Okay. All right. That was a. Now I lost my spot. Okay, Mr. Michel, thank you very much. At this time, I'm setting House Senate Bill 26 aside. And our next bill we'll hear is House Bill 123, an act establishing the Marijuana Control Board, relating to the powers and duties of the Marijuana Control Board, relating to the appointment, removal, and duties of the director of the Marijuana Control Board, relating to the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and providing for an effective date. This bill is by the governor. Here to refresh us on the bill is Ms. Cynthia Franklin, Executive Director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Ms. Franklin, please place yourself on the record and give an overview for the committee.
My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. The bill creates a five-member volunteer board that is serviced by the same agency that assists the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board in its work. The result would be a two-board, one-agency setup with identical size boards working on both substances, and a shared staff of a director plus a total of 16 employees statewide who are licensing, enforcement, and administrative employees.
Any questions from the committee? Ms. Wilson, or Representative Wilson.
That's okay. I can answer to just about anything, Mr. Chair. So I guess I have questions on the fiscal note. Is this okay to do it now? Or you want to take public testimony first?
Oh, we can do public testimony first.
That's fine.
And bring it back. Any further questions from the committee? Okay. At this time, I'd like to open up House Bill 123 for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 123? Okay. Online, we have public testimony from Timothy Hale in Anchorage. Mr. Hale, are you there? Not there? Mr. Hale? Mr. Hale, we can't hear you. Is there anybody else online? That is it. He must have stepped away from the phone. Is there anybody else in the room or online to testify on House Bill 123? Okay, this brings House Bill 123. I'm going to close public testimony. I'm sorry Mr. Hale was not available. Public testimony is closed. We're back with the committee for discussion. Is there further discussion? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm just looking at the fiscal note, and I'm, this time's in the right column, so this is not informational only. So I guess I'm trying to, on the $756,400 under services, what services are we talking about?
Oh, Ms. Franklin, can you answer that, or do we need to go to Office of Administrative Hearings is the only other one I have online.
Mr. Chair, my name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the services category includes a database for the licensees and some software to track marijuana. There's some software that exists that's called seed-to-sale software that is designed to make sure that marijuana that is sold in retail outlets is marijuana that was legally grown designed to track the substance so that we know where the marijuana came from. And so the budget includes an initial outlay of $500,000 for technological costs to track both licensees and the marijuana, and then the out-year costs are slightly less because it would be we would still have to maintain, obviously, whatever technological suite we obtain, but it would be less than the first-year costs.
And a follow-up? So that's 500 of the 756. So what would be the other 256,000?
The other 256,000 includes vehicles for the enforcement officers, includes all of the associated costs with the employees, the office lease costs, the additional costs around having the additional employees. Sorry, through the chair.
And follow up. So with this amount, you know, and anticipated licensing, it is, I'm assuming it would be that we would take this amount of money and we would divide it amongst how many licensees that we have so that this eventually in 2017 would be zero. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we do anticipate all the costs of regulation of marijuana to be receipt supported, yes, once we get the licenses out.
And one last question.
One last question.
So how much do you anticipate the, just based on the $1.5 million that a license would cost, if you had to just approximate based on what they've seen in other, you know, states, especially with us having a smaller population?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the closest comparison that we found is the city of Denver, which is a population of 650,000. They've issued approximately 900 marijuana licenses, and they actually, in their first year, originally added 16 full-time employees. They went back mid-year and amended their ask to add 21 additional, so they added 37 full-time employees for the regulation of marijuana in the city of Denver. Their total costs for those full-time employees and the surrounding services is $5.9 million. That was fully funded by receipts. The city of Denver actually made $14 million in tax revenue for marijuana through October 31st of 2014, and of that, $6 million of it was earmarked to support the regulatory costs around the substance.
Well, I guess oil's not the only thing we have now.
I'd like to apologize. We did close public testimony, but we had a little technical glitch, and we do have two people left that we didn't get connected. So I'm going to go back to opening public testimony. Online from Kasiloff, we have Leif Abel. Mr. Abel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you'd place yourself on the record, and we'd like to hear a brief public testimony from you, please.
For the record, my name is Leif Abel from Kasiloff, Alaska. Through the chair, I would like to thank you guys for having public testimony on this bill, and I just am calling in to briefly support this bill. I think Governor Walker and everybody there who supports this bill has the right idea. I think that having a marijuana control board and having one specifically combined or kind of working underneath the same government agency as the alcohol control board is a good idea. It's the way to go for the state as far as regulating this, and it's the way to go for the state probably financially. And I'd also like to say that I think that Cynthia Franklin has really done a good job of educating herself on this and would do a great job running the Marijuana Control Board. And that is all that I have to say on that today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hale. No, excuse me, Mr. Abel. We also have still as an open line is Timothy Hale. Mr. Hale, are you available now? Apparently he is not. So I will again close public testimony on House Bill 123. This brings it again back to committee for discussion. Further discussion on House Bill 123?
really brief.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, and this is for Cynthia Franklin. The Marijuana Control Board, the qualifications listed, there's five board members similar in respect to the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. For the ABC board, there's two alcohol folks and then generally three other public members. This seems to really delineate what their backgrounds are of this, and I'd like to just hear a statement on why that was made.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the current makeup of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board under Title IV rules is four rules as they exist, does just have two industry designations, three public members, one of whom must be from a rural area. Senate Bill 99 contains the work that the Title IV stakeholders group did on board composition, and that bill does contain an alteration to the composition of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board to reflect the type of designations that you see in this bill, HB 123. So that was the result of some fairly extensive work with our public safety and public health partners in wishing to see designations on these boards that more thoroughly reflect some of the concerns from various partners in the community around the substances.
Great. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee or discussion?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Franklin, could you, and I apologize if it's available to me in the record, I've not seen it, give me a brief idea of how you're going to develop the costs, the prices for the regulations and the fees that will be charged to licensees.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the bill itself contains a $5,000 cap on licensing fees and also designates that half of the licensing fees must be returned to municipalities if the licensed premise is located within a municipality. Our fees for alcohol vary from approximately $1,250 to the mid-3,000s for biennial license that's renewed every other year. So we anticipate exploring fees in Colorado and Washington, our sister states that have legalized marijuana recreationally, and evaluating the needs, the licensing needs compared to what we have in alcohol. An alcohol or liquor license process is fairly extensive and does take quite a bit of staff time. Senate Bill 99, again, the recommended revisions to Title IV does contain an increase in fees to reflect the amount of work and time that goes into those licensing processes and to make certain that the agency has is able to be receipts funded for the necessary licensing and enforcement activities. So we would anticipate those fees coming in near the cap that's set in the statute.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. And you've done a very good job, and I really appreciate it. My question concerns the ability to track and understand what's going on in this new legal industry. I think the problem that I'm going to ask is already it's still a problem in Washington, Colorado. How do you deal with tracking an industry that is not able to bank? I was at an NCSL conference where we had the executive director of the National Bankers Association and somebody from Colorado, and they both agreed there's no way to bank. And in addition to that, how have they dealt with receiving money from an industry where the federal government considers it a money laundering? How are they dealing with an industry giving you a check which the government feels is an illegal source?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the banking issue is a very difficult issue, I agree, and every indication that we have received here in Alaska is that at least at first this industry is going to be unbanked. In Colorado, the industry is considered underbanked because they do have some banking solutions for about 40% of the marijuana businesses in Colorado. So we're certainly going to be looking at those solutions and whether they would translate across. The Cole Memorandum describes a mandate that for states that have legalized marijuana either medically or recreationally, that a strict enforcement scheme that lessens or minimizes the criminal activity around the substance is imperative. So in order to stay on the right side of the feds in terms of regulations, we're basically charged with the task of being very strict and making sure that we're minimizing the opportunity for criminal activity, and by having to deal in a cash industry that in many ways maximizes the risk of criminal activity. So the way that Washington State and Colorado have dealt with that is they do have businesses paying their taxes in cash. We are working with the tax division to make certain that if we miss the taxes on the growing end and we discover later, further downstream, that any licensed establishment has marijuana that has not been taxed, that we have the statutory provisions to pick that up wherever it's discovered and tax it. So in other words, to prevent that criminality by having black market marijuana appear downstream in the established, in the marijuana establishments, in the retail outlets, for instance, that has not been grown in the market. That seed-to-sell software that I discussed earlier is a key tool in both of those states to make sure that the marijuana being sold at the to the consumer is marijuana that was legally grown. So it's an elaborate tracking system, and it's something that we haven't done before and that is not really comparable to alcohol because it is a plant. So I think it's a formidable task. But I do think that that these other states have managed to do it, and it's something we can do because we're Alaskans.
Right? Thank you. Yeah, just follow up.
Follow up, Representative Guttenberg.
And the software you talked about purchasing, does it come out of the vendor that they're using it outside in one of those states where it is comparable to doing all those things that you're going to need to do?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there are several options for the software. We haven't begun looking at those yet because our funding hasn't been passed. But the, I think Washington and Colorado both use a software system called BioTrack. There are some other options out there. There are 22 states that have legalized a medical marijuana. Many of them have dispensaries and therefore are using a tracking software. So there are several options out there for us, and we fully intend to explore all of them and come up with what's best for us.
Thank you.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're talking about FDIC and banking and so on and so forth, I can't help but to think that even our cash is a federal document. It's certainly not, we don't have our own state money, so we have federal cash, if you will. So how come that doesn't fall under the federal guidelines?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, I don't think that anyone has tried that yet, in terms of arguing that you can't even pay for marijuana with paper money because it's issued by the federal government. The other states are certainly receiving cash payments, both for taxes, for the excise taxes, and at the city governments as well. So as I mentioned, we know how much money these states have collected from these businesses, and I haven't seen any thing regarding a legal challenge of the type that you're discussing.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is possibly not essential to the consideration of the bill, but curiosity compels me. Other states that regulate marijuana, how do you track it? Is it unitized and sealed in a plastic bag and then an ID chip or something, or an RFID? Just curious, how do they control other states?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, exactly. There's an RFID tagging system. When the plants are actually not grown from seeds, they're grown from cuttings. So the cultivators that we visited had a series of mother plants they took cuttings from, and began growing those, when they reached 8 inches tall, they were required to be tagged. That tag was required to stay with the plant. So when the plant itself grew out and the bud, leaf, and trim were harvested from the plant, the tag remained with that product and followed it all the way through to if you walked into a store and you purchased an edible product that was made with THC extracted from that plant, it would have that same RFID tag associated with it. You could follow that plant sort of from birth at 8 inches tall all the way through to its sale to the consumer on the other end, and then it was cleared out of this system at the back end on the sale.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. I want to go back to, you mentioned the license fees that are in the bill, and I actually didn't see that in the bill. Besides that, I want to talk, have we decided how we are going to issue the license? My understanding from previous conversations at some point in time was that that would be determined by the board, that there might be a thought that the way that the ABC board has handled the licensing, that might not be the direction that we want to go in the future. We might want to do another direction that gives the state a little bit more both authority as well as opportunity in terms of the value of those licenses that right now we're not able to benefit from because of the way that we currently issue licenses with the ABC board. Is that correct? And is that in here, or is that in another bill, or is that something that regulation you guys will be able to handle?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the determination of how to issue licenses and whether or not to issue population limits is left to the ABC board in AS 1738 as one of the 9 areas of regulation, or a marijuana control board if the legislature creates it. In alcohol, we have a population limited system with transferability. That has led to a lot of issues, and what I believe what you're referencing, the concept of a secondary market value for a liquor license. There has been discussion among the board, and we discussed it very briefly in our preliminary considerations document, the concept of going with a high quality merit-based selection system. And Nevada has an example of this where you have a merit-based matrix where an applicant receives points for meeting certain qualifications, and then you start out really just licensing your highest quality applicants, as opposed to a minimum qualification system with a lottery, which is what Washington State went with. So sort of everyone who minimally qualifies, you then decide by chance who gets a limited number of licenses. One of the issues with that is you might end up licensing the business is least likely to succeed and most likely to not be able to or willing to comply with the strict rules that you've set. So the merit-based matrix system is a concept of not limiting licenses on the front end. However, AS 1738 clearly contemplates municipalities retaining the right to set numerical limits on the number of licenses issued within their own municipal government limits. So the combination of a high qualification merit-based system without transferability, so that if you have a business that it ends up not being successful, you don't create that speculation aspect of trying to get a marijuana license, your business fails, and then you're able to sell it on some secondary market, transfer the right to the license on a secondary market, instead have no population limits at the state level, high merit-based matrix, and non-transferability, so that if the business fails, the license is surrendered to the state. And that's some concepts that have been discussed among the regulations-making team that's taking preliminary look, but that is the type of issue that would be openly and publicly debated in the regulations-making process.
So one follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Pruitt.
So appreciate that. Thank you. That's very, very helpful. One of the things that I'm curious about, though, if we decide to go with this merit-based system, which does not facilitate that both the secondary market as well as even potentially our ability to say, hey, you don't have a secondary market, but we're going to put a value on it and we'll sell it at that rate. Is there still, do you have the authority to increase value or the amount of that license without coming back to us? One of the concerns I always have is in some of these cases is then it gets lost in the legislative process. You're not able to cover your costs. And now we're having to put general fund in to pay for that. Is that and again, I don't know if that was in here or if that's already was an initiative, something that you already deal with. But do you have the ability to increase the fees based on your cost if we go with that merit based?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, both the license selection process and the rate of the fees, I believe, are intended to be set by regulation to avoid the very issue you discuss. And the reference that I made to 1738 was not a set fee of $5,000. Rather, it was a limitation in the statute of having high fees. Some of the things we've seen in these other states is astronomical fees being attached to the license with the idea of discouraging the market. And so I believe that the authors of the initiative intended to set a fee cap in order to limit the ability of either the legislature or the regulatory body to create astronomical fees.
Can I follow up on that last piece?
Follow up, Representative Pruitt.
What is the definition of, you know, high fees? How is that defined?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, in one state, I believe that the initial fee was $25,000. And so it's obviously a sliding scale, but there are states where the fees are in the tens, 20s, $30,000. So it naturally limits the ability of applicants to get into the industry by the entry fee itself being completely out of proportion to the entry fee for other types of licenses that are issued by the state. So we believe that if we keep the fees logical in relation to what the applicant is getting and the type of work that has to go into issuing the license, if it's related, they're going to be deemed reasonable. Even if we get into this work and we discover that $5,000 is really not high enough, we've discussed with our attorneys the concept of if we had to charge higher fees, as long as we can relate the fees to services and make it understandable why the fees are the rate that they are, versus just having high fees that seem to be high for no reason.
Okay, so again, the definition. I mean, I understand what other states are doing, what they have done, but the definition, is there right now a $5,000 cap that potentially there might be some gray area at some point with those attorneys? I mean, I'm trying to make sure that there's not a limit that what is that definition, and I don't want a barrier to us to be able to cover our cost when it comes to handling the licensing because of some sort of little wording that's either been placed by us or others. So what is the definition of high for, according to either our initiative or what we've got in front of us?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the initiative states that the regulatory body shall impose reasonable fees and not to exceed $5,000. Those are relatable to the liquor licensing fees in such a manner that we anticipate we can make those fees work for us. Once we get into the actual regulation and determining what it takes to issue a license in this new industry, if it becomes apparent at some point that $5,000 will not cover, as you've indicated, the services that are required in order to issue the licenses, then we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But we feel confident that as long as we have the backup to show that it's not adequate to cover, that we can that we can continue to work on that. I mean, we're taking the $5,000 as a statute, which the voters have passed, but since this industry has never been regulated before and these licenses have never been issued before, we don't really know the cost of the regulation. What you have before you in the form of a fiscal note is the initial cost that we're anticipating we're able to do it for in a fiscally challenged environment. That cost initially was much higher, as set forth by my predecessor at the time the voter initiative was placed on the ballot. We've trimmed that because the state is broke, and we're trying to get this voter initiative implemented for in the safest way possible for the least amount of money possible, and we try to get as creative as we could to get these first and second year costs down to a manageable level so that we can implement the will of the voters in the most fiscally responsible and conservative way.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And last thing, please let us know as you go forward if that covers it, or if you feel that will not be able to cover it. Because my view, and I would expect that the people that voted for it would, I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of things we had to take it all or leave it. Is that there wasn't an expectation that general funds and should be covering this, and I think that would probably be an appropriate conversation for us to be aware of. So please let us know.
Is there further discussion? Seeing that there is no further discussion, I would entertain a motion. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move CS for House Bill Number 123, Judiciary 29-GH1110/P from committee with one fiscal note and individual recommendations.
I think there's
any objection.
There's two fiscal notes. With attached fiscal notes, that way we don't have to number them.
Attached fiscal notes. Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 123 is passed through House Finance, and we'll do a brief intermission while we sign the paperwork. House Finance is back in session. The next bill up today is House Bill 154, an act allowing appropriations to the Civil Legal Services Fund from court filing fees. It's by Representative Bryce Edgemond. Along with him is his staff, Tim Clark. If you guys would please come to the table. And we also have other people in the room, but we'll get back to them. If you place yourselves on the record, we'll hear your House Bill 154.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 37. And accompanying me is my staff, Tim Clark. And I'm wondering if my mic is live. It sounds like it's getting live as we speak here. House Bill 154, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for bringing the bill before the committee for hearing today. Basically, would create a mechanism that would allow for a more stable funding source, state appropriation to the Alaska Legal Services Fund. And the way the bill works is it would appropriate into that fund 25% of all the filing fees that has paid the Alaska court system during the previous years. Alaska Legal Services, as I think this committee knows, plays a pretty vital role in being able to provide civil legal services to a vast variety of Alaskans. In fact, the last 30 years or so, we've seen a near doubling of the eligibility of those who need the services from some 41,000 to 100,000. The Alaska Legal Services also is virtually present in all of the hub communities in Alaska, including Anchorage, Fairbanks, the Mat-Su, Juneau, Kenai, Ketchikan, Dillingham, and so forth and so on. The Alaska Legal Services, I guess I would close with just those brief introductory points by pointing out that the funding sources for Alaska Legal Services come from a variety of sources. It's had to draw on not only state funds to some extent, but also federal, local foundations, private donations from Alaska Native organizations. And so House Bill 154, in light of the budget times that we're in now, basically would allow for a quarter of all the filing fees paid the Alaska court system from the previous year to go into fund that would help provide Alaska Legal Services a stable state funding source. So with that, Mr. Co-Chairman, I have my staff here to elaborate further on the bill if necessary, and I think those should provide introductory comments.
And we do have other people in the room to help answer questions. We have Ms. Nicole Nelson, the Executive Director of the Alaska Legal Services Corporation, here to answer questions. I see Nancy Mead from the Alaska Courts. Okay. Questions from the committee? Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Edgman or whoever can answer this. How much money are we talking about that would be appropriate? What does 25% of the filing fees equate to?
Well, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, if we look at last year's court filing fees, it was $2.2 million. So about a quarter of that comes up to, 25% of the 2014 filing fees. A quarter of that would be about $563,000. And the Alaska Legal Services, and I realize that the operating budget is still under deliberation, but right now I believe it's in both the House and the Senate for $350,000, down from $550,000 of a year ago. So that number is somewhere, you know, somewhat equal to what it had gotten from the state here recently.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But this bill doesn't appropriate any money. This just allows the legislature, if they want to put it in this fund, but it doesn't have to if we don't have any money.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. It essentially just creates program receipt authority. And I was just corrected by my staff here. It's in the existing budget. It's $450,000 for Alaska Legal Services, not $350,000.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, how recently or how often are court filing fees adjusted? My question is, how often do the court filing fees change, and have they been increased, or do they float with inflation, or what's the...
Mr. Co-Chair, that's a perfect question for the court system staff.
Nancy Mead, would you please come forward and give us a hand?
Please.
Place yourself on the record.
Certainly. Thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. The Alaska Court System has not raised its filing fees in about 10 or might be 12 years, and it is actually right now in the midst of deciding to increase those fees. It does so when it feels it's appropriate, I guess. The Supreme Court changes its rule, and because of the state's fiscal picture right now, the court is deciding to change them effective July 1. Those filing fees will increase. So they'll increase by quite a bit. Say, last year I think our filing fees were about $2.2 million, and if the Supreme Court does what it's considering doing by July 1st, they'll go up by another $1.2 million. Which would, of course, increase this 25%. So,
you mind, through the chair,
follow up, Representative Sadler.
Is that the addition of how much to what total?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in FY14, our filing fee revenue was about $2.2 million, and the proposal that the court is considering and is quite likely to do would increase those fees by another $1.2 million.
Such that we'd have 3.4.
Okay. Yeah. With the effect of increasing this 25% number by about 300,000, roughly, through the chair.
All right. Is there further questions from the committee of Ms. Mead or the staff? All right. Seeing no further questions from the committee, at this time I'd like to open House Bill 154 for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 154? I think we do have a couple of people here. Denise Daniela. Denise, if you place yourself on the record, we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Denise Daniello, Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging, and on behalf of the Commission, I'm here to offer the Commission's support for House Bill 154, sponsored by Representative Edgman. Alaska Legal Services would be the primary recipient of funds through the Civil Legal Services Fund, and they have helped last year 850 seniors. And the Commission has four quarterly board meetings a year, and from time to time we do receive public testimony from seniors in support of the services they receive from Alaska Legal Services, where it be help with establishing Miller Trusts, guardianships, conservatorships, advanced directives, and so on. And we have heard no complaints about Alaska Legal Services, and we are in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Denise. Also, here in Juneau in the room, we have Doug Wolliver. Doug is gone. Mr. Wolliver has left. All right, we're going to go online now to Patrick Reinhart.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Patrick Reinhart. I'm with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, Mr. Reinhart.
Good afternoon.
Sorry about that. I'm calling on behalf of the council. We'd like to extend our support for HB 154. We feel that it will positively impact Alaska's most vulnerable populations, including people with disabilities. For low-income Alaskans with disabilities, we understand that Alaska Legal Services have provided about 40% of their clientele has been people with disabilities. And the typical services they provide have been preventing illegal eviction due to their disability, assistance with civil protective orders to stop abuse and challenging denials of health care coverage, or federal benefit denials through SSI and SSDI. In addition, they assist family caregivers with documents needed to secure health care services and other domestic things like helping children enroll in school. And we know these are free services to low-income Alaskans, and we understand that Alaska Legal Services also has to turn away roughly about half of the requests for assistance that they get for lack of funds and staff to support that. So we fully support 154. We hope you're committee will do so as well, and we urge you to pass it out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reinhart. Representative Sadler has a question for you.
Thank you. Hey, Patrick, I understand that many of your clients do avail themselves of the services of Alaska Legal Services. If we could do the similar thing for the Disability Law Center, would that help your clients even more, or would that be duplicative?
Well, they do kind of different through the Representative Sadler said the chair. They do kind of different elements of disability support. Our understanding, Alaska Legal Services are helping more on the civil side of life and things that come up, whereas Disability Law Services takes on cases that are more related to, you know, special education, very specific to disability law. Sometimes there's some overlap, I'm sure, but I'm not familiar enough to know, you know, what the impact could be. But, you know, but the funding sources for something like Disability Law Services is a whole different stream than this one, although maybe they would be eligible under a fund like this as well. I guess that would be determined.
Thank you, Mr. Reinhart. Thank you for your testimony. Also online we have Nicole Nelson from Alaska Legal Services wishing to testify. Nicole, are you there? Nicole Nelson, are you there? She must have stepped
away. I am here. Can you,
yes,
can you hear me?
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Place yourself on the record and we'll hear your testimony.
Sure. My name is Nicole Nelson, and I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Legal Services for the record. And I wanted to thank Chair Thompson for hearing and the fellow committee members for hearing this important bill today, and Representative Edgman for sponsoring it. Alaska Legal Services is a nonprofit law firm that's been providing free legal services to low-income people for 45 years since we opened our doors. And the services we provide are aimed at meeting the critical civil legal needs of low-income people that help stabilize their families and secure their safety and family stability and self-sufficiency. And our job is to ensure that there's access to the civil justice system versus the criminal justice system. We assist parents who may be being abused and who do not have the financial means to leave an abusive relationship and may fear losing custody of their children if they do. We help grandparents who are caring for their grandchildren and need to get their legal paperwork in order to enroll them in school or to help them access the health care they need. We assist on a regular basis veterans who may be denied their federal VA benefits despite the fact that they have earned them through their service to this country and have been left with disabilities that leave them unable to work. And for all of these problems, there's a civil legal solution. But unlike in criminal cases where defendants are guaranteed a court-appointed attorney if they cannot afford one, civil cases have no such right. And so for these folks and thousands like them, ALSC is really their only hope to access the civil justice system. Each year, we're able to help over 2,500 Alaskans. And in last year alone, we served folks in 162 different Alaskan communities. We do this through our staff attorneys and a vast network of pro bono lawyers who donate their time and their expertise to further our efforts. And we serve thousands more through our self-help and community education efforts. However, the problem is we also had to turn away hundreds of families last year because we didn't have the resources to help. We had to turn away one for each one that we were able to serve. And we turned them away not because there weren't laws that would protect them and not because their cases lacked merit, but we turned them away because we lacked the staff and resources to help. And this is particularly heart-wrenching when we know that there are laws that could prevent these outcomes. And then if we had the resources to help, we could make a difference. We are remarkably successful in achieving positive outcomes for our clients. We do so in 86% of the cases we take on, and we are also incredibly cost-efficient. We resolve our cases, 80% of our cases are resolved without ever having to go to court. Each case costs us, on average, about $600. Our attorneys are paid far below the market rate for either the private bar or state attorneys. An attorney, for example, starting work in our Anchorage office would make about $42,000 a year. And we are leveraging resources with donated office space and support from local communities, and also volunteers and private donations. Last year, we were able to leverage almost $500,000 in donated services through volunteers. but we can't. So in short, we're doing what we can, but we cannot meet this community need on our own. And when we say the Pledge of Allegiance, we close with justice for all. And Legal Aid ensures that that very principle that our founding fathers envisioned remains alive. If passed, HB 154 would go a long ways towards assuring that there is justice for all in the civil context. I thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nelson. Okay. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify on 154? Anyone else online? Seeing none, I'm closing public testimony at this time. Does the sponsor of the bill have any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, just a quick clarification, my second of afternoon. The bill does not create a program receipt authority. It simply puts language, inserts it into the Title VII Legal Services Fund that allows the legislature to appropriate funds from the court filing fees from the previous year. So I just wanted to make
that. Thank you, Representative Edgman. Okay, this brings House Bill 154 back before the committee for discussion. Is there further discussion? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it sounded like most of the testimony was pretty confused. I mean, all the testimony made it seem like we were putting money into a fund that this bill allows receipt authority to do that if we do this. So I guess I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, we could put as much money into this fund as we want as far as appropriating. Is that not correct?
Representative Edgman?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Well, what this bill does, and of course it's at the direction of the legislature, future legislatures, it creates a funding mechanism for 25% of filing fees from that go in the court services for civil cases to be then appropriated to the legal services entity. So it's future oriented. It doesn't guarantee any money. It doesn't involve any appropriation language per se. But it just gives the legislature the authority to provide money to Alaska Legal Services.
And follow up.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
And I appreciate that and understand that. But I guess my question, though, is let's say we triple how much oil is coming down tomorrow, and we wanted to put $1 million into this fund. We wouldn't need anything except an appropriation bill before us to do that, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm just trying to... You know, I mean, I understand the mechanism of the 25% that somebody down the line, if we have money, can then put it in. It would be DGF, but, you know, I don't know why we would limit ourselves because we could put more money into it right now if we have the money. I just don't want to give the wrong impression to the public, and it just seemed like the public thought we were putting money into this right now, which I don't think was the sponsor's intent.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the sponsor, is it fair assumption that you knew about the there would be an increase in court filing fees? Did you know that was coming down the pike or likely to come down the pike here?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. So the more money they can get in there, the better, I think, is what might be your orientation.
And there's no guarantee that the Supreme Court is going to increase those fees yet. They say they're going to by July, but they haven't yet. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, so the question I have is if right now because it says we may appropriate to the fund only from amounts deposited in the general fund of the state under AS 9720J. So if we're currently not, and that says if a person receives an award of punitive damages, court shall require that 50% of the award be deposited into the general fund of the state. If currently we're not awarding from this 50% of the punitive damages, why should we add something else that we could potentially appropriate from? That it's at this point, I mean, it just seems like we're just grabbing things and saying we may appropriate from it. Why not just go ahead and instead we try to, why not appropriate like it says to?
Representative Edgman, staff, Mr. Clark would like to answer this.
Before I defer to my staff, Mr. Chairman, well, the whole intent of this bill is to recognize that with the huge budget shortfalls that we have, that this may, in fact, provide a more stable funding source down the road than what exists today through the general fund. The filing fees, whether or not the Supreme Court does improve and increase approve the funding increase that we believe that going forward it will provide sort of a continuum of funding, if you will, to the point where if we took a quarter of it and put it into this legal services fund, this is a civil legal services fund, that would at least give legal services, which has to depend on a myriad of funding sources, at least in terms of one component of their overall budget, some stability going forward. So, again, there's some, certainly uncertainty into what could come through this fund. There's clearly uncertainty what could come through the general fund vis-a-vis the normal appropriation process with the legislature. So, this bill by no means is a sure thing going forward, but I think I would argue, as well as others who support the bill, that it does provide perhaps more certainty relative to that certain funding level that legal services has come to depend upon. A funding level that at one point in the 80s was a lot higher from the state. It was well over $1 million. I think, as we heard Ms. Nelson speak, they've had to turn away hundreds of Alaskan families in the process. At least last
Mr. year. Clark, would you like to add to the answer? Place yourself on the record again just so they can get it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Edgman. And in answer to Representative Pruitt's question, Mr. Chairman, when the Civil Legal Services Fund was first established, the capitalization was designed to come from punitive damages collected by the state. Unfortunately, in the last 3 years, the state has collected zero punitive damages, so the fund has remained uncapitalized. So this legislation would allow for a different funding stream. So.
Can I follow up on that?
Follow up, Representative Pruitt.
The way I read this, annually the legislature may appropriate refers to both the punitive damages that we're talking about. It also, the may also applies to the 25% of the filing fees. Do I read that correct? And then the second part that I would add to that is, when was the last time that we did have punitive damage money, and did we appropriate it at that point in time?
Thank you. Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the second half of your question I would defer to the executive director, who is online, Nicole Nelson. The first part of the question is, Representative Pruitt, to the chair, you're absolutely correct that there is nothing in this legislation that requires an appropriation. Both the appropriation of the up to 25% of the court filing fees is at the discretion of the legislature, and an appropriation from the fund to the Legal Services Corporation would once again be at the discretion of the legislature. That also goes back to Representative Wilson's question about, does this legislation in fact concretely appropriate a penny to legal services? And the answer is no. It simply gives the legislature the discretion to do so, and it's in a way, in terms of the existence of the fund, it's sort of an acknowledgement by the legislature of the importance of these services to Alaska.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Tim, anybody actually, are there more than one organizations in Alaska that provide civil legal services to low-income individuals other than Legal Services Corporation?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, none that I'm aware of, although once again I would prevail on Nicole Nelson, the Legal Services Corporation Executive Director, to answer that question.
Is she online?
I don't have anybody online.
Nancy Meter on?
I'm here, Representative.
You are there. Okay.
Thompson?
Yes, go right ahead. Place yourself on the record again and answer the question, please.
This is Nicole Nelson, the Executive Director of Alaska Legal Services. And through the chair, I will address the two questions that I think were left for me. The first question through the chair, Representative Pruitt, is whether or not there have been any appropriations from the Civil Legal Services Fund based on the current authorizing language through punitive damages funds. And the answer to that question is there was one appropriation in 2011 of $110,000, and that encompassed all of the punitive damages awarded to the state over the 5 years from 2007 through 2011 that were available for appropriation. So there's been one appropriation, and it was for a total of $110,000, and that was the total amount that had been available to appropriate. Secondly, through the chair, Representative Sadler, your question about whether or not there are other providers of free legal services in Alaska, and the answer to that question is yes, there are some other organizations that provide free civil legal services, but we are the only statewide provider of comprehensive free legal services across the board. The other organizations, for instance, like Disability Law Center, provides niche services or more restricted services. They're not comprehensive civil legal services providers.
So, follow up, Representative Sadler.
So, to follow up on that, so there's nothing in this this bill or current law that would prevent, well, I guess the question is, so do Disability Law Center or any of the other niche services ever receive funds from the Civil Legal Services Fund? To your knowledge, I can't ask you to speak for them, but to your knowledge.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, to my knowledge, the only appropriation from this fund happened in 2011, and it was for the $110,000 that I spoke of earlier.
Okay. Thank you, Nicole.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So obviously Representative Wilson is right. Just because you say you're going to put money into an account doesn't mean it's dedicated, because the Constitution doesn't allow you to do that. But we tend to try and honor those things where the money is available, like the Alaska Housing Capital Income Fund, which we try to use for capital projects. There's no obligation that we do, but we tend to do it. Of course, it's an annual decision. But the reason why this bill actually works better than the current mechanism is this bill, we will know what 25% of court filing fees are. We'll be able to calculate that. It's an easily calculable number. The problem with the existing law is the state's entitled to, I think, 50% of all punitive damage verdicts and settlements that come in. But that's never really been enforceable, because when parties settle their cases, they settle their cases and they say this all relates to compensatory damages, not punitive damages. And so, therefore, they're able to get around the part that says, well, what punitive damages did we get? Well, the party settled, and they said that none of them were punitive damages. And they have incentives to do that. The state has incentives. The parties have incentives. All the parties have incentives to underreport the punitive damages. So that part has never really been enforced. That's why there's never been any money put into it in any substantial way. Representative Edgman's bill will come up with a quantifiable amount that we'll be able to see on paper. And he's given better testimony. He can explain the bill from there on. But it's more quantifiable. You'll be able to see the number on a piece of paper. It's not dodgeable like the existing law.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Okay, is there any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I would entertain a motion to move House Bill 154, Version A, from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill number 154-29-LS0765-A from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 154 has passed through committee, and we'll take a brief intermission for a brief at ease to sign the bill. bring this meeting of the House Finance Committee back to order. We're back on the record. Our final bill of the day will be House Bill 105. The short title is ADA, Bonds, Programs, Loans, LNG Project by the Governor. We have a CS for this bill, version N. And
you want to move it? Is it working?
You have the... Okay, Representative Wilson.
I'd like to move CS for House Bill Number 105, Finance 29-GH1019, /N, as a working document.
No objections. Today, Ms. Pearson, my Chief of Staff, will explain the differences between version P and the CS version N. Ms. Pearson, if you'd place yourself on the record and explain the differences between version P and version N.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. In Section 1, there is no change. Section 2 inserts new language, allowing an Interior Alaska utility that is owned and operated by a political subdivision of the state and receives financing from the Sustainable Energy Transmission and Supply Development Fund to exempt itself from utility rate regulation by resolution. Section 3, no change. Section 4, no change. Section 5, no change. Section 6, no change. Section 7 removes subsection 1 regarding the ADA acquisition of gas reserves, which is discussed in Section 8. Language in subsection 2 is incorporated into C and modified. The words negotiate or are removed. To provide natural gas to the Interior Alaska as a primary market are added on page 6, lines 29 through 30. The words uses or serves customers in Interior Alaska are added on page 7, lines 2 through 3. Section 8 inserts new Section 8, amending AS 4480-690A regarding the ADA Sustainable Energy Transmission and Supply Development Fund, to require ADA to obtain legislative approval before using the fund to purchase or acquire gas reserves or gas lease or becoming a working interest partner of a natural gas lease. Version E, Section 8 is renumbered to 9 in Section N. Section 10, a new Section 10 is inserted, providing ADA bonding authorization up to $50 million to finance the acquisition, design, and construction of a port facility and equipment related to the development and operation of a bulk commodity loading and shipping terminal to be located at Port McKenzie. Section 11 is renumbered from Section 9 in Version E. It prepares a project plan and receives legislative approval of the plan, is replaced with approves a project plan. On page 7, line 16. Section 12, renumbered from version N. Section 13, renumbered as section 13, used to be section 11, is modified to remove the repeal of section 2, Chapter 27, SLA 1993, as amended by Section 19, Chapter 111, pertaining to the Port McKenzie Bonding Authority authorization. Section 14 inserts is a new section providing legislative authority for ADA to issue up to $120 million of bonds to finance the infrastructure and construction costs of the Sweetheart Lake Hydroelectric Project, and we have already heard that in a bill. Section 15 is a new section providing legislative authority for the Alaska Energy Authority to loan the amount up to $3 million from the Power Project Fund to the City of King Cove for the Waterfall Creek Hydroelectric Project. Section 12, renumbered to Section 16 in Version N. Section 17 is a new section repealing Section 14 and 15 of this Act, which is the Sweetheart Lake and the King Cove Waterfall Creek Hydroelectric Project by June 30th, 2019. And Section 18, Version E, Section 13 is renumbered as Section 18 in Version N.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Here to interview.
Can I just ask a clarification?
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was this a comparing version? I heard P.
Version E, the one that came out of resources.
Thank you. That's what I thought.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Here to introduce House Bill 105 to the committee is Mr. Gene Theriault, AIDA's Energy Policy Outreach Director, Mr. Nick Zamoniak, AIDA's Energy Development Finance Officer, Fred Paraday, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and did I leave anybody out? Maybe not. Gentlemen, please place yourselves on the record and tell us about House Bill 105.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Fred Paraday. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nick Shimoniak, Energy Infrastructure Development Officer at AIDA.
Gene Theriault, Director with the Alaska Energy Authority.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have a brief presentation on House Bill 105. We're appreciative of the opportunity to join you today and very much appreciate your time in this committee meeting this afternoon. I wanted to step back first to the goals for the Interior Energy Project under Senate Bill 23. Which remain as they were when it passed this body in 2013. It's to supply natural gas to interior Alaska at the lowest cost possible to as many Alaska customers as possible as soon as possible. The investments in IEP complement the eventual sources of gas supply from a natural gas pipeline, which remains uncertain in its own right, of course. But one of the key elements of the discussion that I wanted to give voice to this afternoon is that it lowers PM 2.5 particulate pollution in the non-attainment areas of the interior. And that level of pollution in the interior is amongst the highest in the United States, in fact, has been compared unfavorably to Beijing. Continuing with the overview, we want to meet the goals set by the legislature to supply affordable energy to interior Alaska. This project is complex, which is why the legislature took action to initiate the project and why we have continued to work diligently in AIDA to bring this project to fruition. We now need to evaluate infrastructure to deliver natural gas from any source, including Cook Inlet, which is what brings us back before you for legislative approval. AIDA is also continuing to finance the build-out of natural gas distribution in Fairbanks and North Pole, which is exciting work to see progress on the ground. So what House Bill 105 does do is give AIDA flexibility to use the SB 23 financing tools with a non-North Slope liquefaction location. The current version of HB 105 also authorizes the financing consideration of propane or small diameter pipeline projects to continue to meet the goals of IEP. Essentially, it authorizes us to evaluate those alternatives. Under Senate Bill 23 in 2013, the only project that is authorized considered a North Slope natural gas supply and liquefaction plant. What we're seeking under House Bill 105 is authorization to consider, essentially to flip the tail of the project from the North Slope to the Cook Inlet and consider a source of gas supply from the south. What that does for the project remains to be seen, but when you look across the alternatives, first of all, when it comes to natural gas supply, when you look at Cook Inlet, the supply remains uncertain, but there are definitely positive indicators in the growth of gas supply in the Cook Inlet compared to the North Slope, where you have an abundant gas supply at low cost, but some existing contracts in place. And the alternatives that need to be considered include propane from Canada, and whether a small pipeline up from Cook Inlet could be better than a rail or truck solution. However, when you get into the liquefaction plant and the other elements of the project, it's on the liquefaction plant, it's cheaper to construct and operate it off the shelf, if you will, to the south as compared to the North Slope, where it's expensive to design and to construct in one of the most expensive operating areas of the state. Again, if you are considering other alternatives, there would not need to be a plant for propane, or the pipeline wouldn't involve a plant. As to the transportation logistics, trucking and rail, Cook Inlet has lower trucking costs, has large trailer potential, and also has a rail option that can be evaluated. Trucking is more expensive but feasible for the North Slope, and one thing that's caught my eye this week, as I'm sure it's caught all of yours, is the closure of the Dalton Highway and the stacking of 300 trucks. I understand that the producers on the North Slope were running 20 aircraft a day, taking load sulfur diesel fuel up north, and it's taken a substantial effort to break that ice jam and bring those trucks back onto the road. If you look at a propane option, you've got marine, rail, and trucking combinations, and, of course, a pipeline is in and of itself transportation. In terms of storage and distribution, there's essentially no difference between a Cook Inlet or a North Slope supply. You've got to bring the gas into the city of Fairbanks, have a storage facility regasified and distributed, and that distribution project is ongoing. Propane and a pipeline. Pipeline would have less storage, but propane is a different study altogether.
Thank you. For the record, Nick Shimoniak, Mr. Chair. The next two slides are going to compare the value chain for a North Slope project versus a Cook Inlet project and how ADA is approaching, or the IEP project team is approaching, each step of the value chain a little differently, right, or whether or not they're the same. Starting with the North Slope, looking at the gas supply, we entered this the North Slope project, SB 23, with two existing contracts between North Slope producers and interior utilities. We had not selected yet a private developer to build the LNG plant on the North Slope. That ended up being MWH, the concession agreement. The trucking, we had always planned on going through the private trucking industry. That remained the plan throughout. And then the LNG storage and regasification distribution systems in the interior. We have begun to finance the build-out of the IGU and FNG distribution systems, and that continues. This North Slope supply chain under the concession agreement came in too expensive, specifically the cost of constructing and operating the LNG plant on the North Slope. That project came before the board, and we terminated that concession agreement, and now we're before the legislature looking for increased flexibility to look at a Cook Inlet or other options. The next slide, looking at Cook Inlet, the biggest difference here is the gas supply. There are no existing agreements between interior utilities and Cook Inlet producers other than the existing 0.95 BCF agreement between FNG and Hillcorp. The LNG production, we, again, like in 2013 with SB 23, we have not yet selected the private developer, but we will select and solicit for private development. The transportation will remain the same. We will plan on going with the private trucking industry. Though with transportation, there are a few other options. We are currently working with Alaska Railroad to explore those options. And the current version of HB 105 before us also allows for a small diameter pipeline, which would replace the trucking and the LNG plant together, as well as a propane option, which would modify the trucking and have a different source for the fuel other than the LNG plant. The LNG storage, regasification, and distribution remain the same for both North Slope or Cook Inlet. And we continue, as I said before, we continue that build out. Turning now to the project execution plan, this is the plan ADA and the IEP project team is planning on looking forward, moving with the passage of HB 105. First, the natural gas supply. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development is taking the lead on that. We are exploring the availability of Cook Inlet natural gas, and we will hope to facilitate commercial agreements between the producers and the interior utilities. ADA will not sign a contract for Cook Inlet natural gas itself, and ADA will not buy reserves or a working interest in a natural gas field in Cook Inlet. Liquefaction. ADA and the IEP project team are planning on going out for competitive solicitation to build and operate liquefaction capacity in Cook Inlet. That is the base case of the RFP we're looking at or going for, but we are open to and encouraging alternative supplies, including another North Slope LNG plant, propane, or a pipeline. Again, ADA will not sign the contracts for the liquefaction plant. It will be the interior utilities, and ADA will facilitate the commercial process and provide financing. Transportation, again, private sector, largely with the trucking industry, we'll advance that. And the storage, regasification, distribution system continues on as planned under each scenario.
Finally, Mr. Chairman, Gene Terrio with AEA. The goals of the IEP remain the same as they were established by Senate Bill 23 by a previous legislature. House Bill 105 authorizes the toolkit that was established, the financing tools, to be utilized to evaluate a source of gas from the south and also the possibility of propane or delivery via a small diameter pipeline, as have been requested by members of the legislature. Our intent is to move forward with a market-driven process to solicit involvement from the private sector, again, as was envisioned when the original financing tools were made available. That ends the PowerPoint presentation. Mr. Chairman, I want to be mindful of the committee's time. I am prepared to walk the committee members through a sectional analysis to the proposed CS, if that's your desire.
I think we'll probably have to move on with the time frame we have and go to public testimony. Is there any questions of the committee directly for these gentlemen at this time? Representative Guerra.
Just very as quickly as you can answer this. So I was supportive of the original Fairbanks plan. I think most of us...
Can you use your microphone, please?
Sure. Okay. Thank you. Just if you could answer this as quickly as possible. I was supportive of the original plan to get affordable gas to Fairbanks, and I know this is switched. I think we all understand that our job is to represent the state, regardless of where we come from. So I tend to be supportive of anything that helps this crisis. That's not as bad as the crisis in rural Alaska, so I believe in helping there too. But here, why have we, if it turns out that gas can come cheaper from the North Slope, and I understand the what you presented in your PowerPoint slide, than it can from Cook Inlet, you determine that the Cook Inlet supply is not as going to be as steady as the North Slope supply would be, would you go back to the original direction? Does anything in this bill stop you from doing that?
Mr. Chairman, to the representative's question, by removing the words North Slope, it does not preclude the North Slope from putting in a bid in the competitive process that we intend to go forward with. So that option is still on the table, and in fact, the possibility of a competitive source from the south may in fact cause those private sector entities that were originally involved in a possible supply off the North Slope to sharpen their pencils and put in a bid that could still result in the supply being from the North Slope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Not sure who can best answer this. Would Ada, in essence, become a utility, owning part of a gas utility through this deal? Or?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Sadler's question, right now the Ada board is doing due diligence on a proposed purchase of Pentex assets. One of the component of that purchase would be the existing FNG distribution system. It would be Ada's intent to have that distribution system, number one, initially be operated through a contract. There's no intent for the state to staff up an LNG or a gas distribution system. Ada ownership will allow the existing FNG system and the developing IGU system to be developed, so they really are fully integrated with each other. That enhances the possibility that ultimately those two can be blended together into one system. Although it is the second largest metropolitan area in the state of Alaska, the actual overall demand for natural gas in the community is relatively small. And so having it currently being served by two separate utilities is less than efficient, and it is our desire to ultimately see it blended into one and within the shortest period of time possible to then have that asset then be sold to it could be the IGU or it could be sold to a private utility operator.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
I saw the terms a couple times as a pretty market-driven solution, but to the extent that ADA is involved, which is a government funding agency, it's a little bit less market-driven than government-driven. So,
questions?
I have a question.
Yeah. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What was the fiscal note on the original gas trucking proposal, and what is the balance now in that fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can provide those numbers to the committee. We have them on a slide in a prior PowerPoint, but roughly there was $150 million in
bonds.
Sets in bonds, and then $125 million in sets loans and $57.5 million in grants. And there has been what's the number committed to the distribution? It's about $45 million. And there's been roughly $55 million committed to the distribution systems out of the loan program.
Follow-up, Representative Munoz.
57 in grants, 150 in SETS funding, did you say? And what was the third amount?
$125
from the SETS fund, to be loaned out from the SETS fund, and an authorization then to bond for an additional $150 million that would also be loaned out. So the primary funding that was made available, other than the $57.5 in grants, were funds to be loaned out and ultimately repaid.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and all of the 57 in grants, 55 has already been committed.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Representative. I do have the slide with me. So of the $57.5 million in grants, $12.4 million has been expended. That was on the North Slope for the plant, direct legal and financial, pad construction, plant engineering and design, and the storage study. Of the SETS loan monies, $52.78 million has been committed, and that's to the two loans to the distribution systems, $15 million to FNG and $37.78 million to IGU. So there's $72.2 million remaining in the SETS loan, and let me get this copied and distributed to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Pruitt, and then I think we will move on to public testimony and come back to committee discussion.
Thank
Representative
you.
Pruitt.
How much gas is this going to move per day?
I haven't calculated in a per day basis. Just one moment.
Through the chair to the representative's question, at peak build-out, the interior Alaska demand will be about 9.5 BCF a year, which on a daily average is about 26 million cubic feet a day.
Follow-up. What impact does that have on the overall reserves within the Coconut Basin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, I have a slide I can share with the committee. There's roughly 10 years of interior demand are roughly 80 BCF the first 10 years, and the Cook Inlet reserves are estimated at TCF. So it's less than 10%. It's about a quarter of the last 10 years of LNG export, and it is about a sixth of the Agrium restart.
Okay. That 1T that you talked about, is that accessible to us? I mean, it's a pretty complex web of ownership throughout the Cook Inlet. I mean, is that really recoverable and realistically recoverable?
To the representative's question, yes, that is the 1P and 2P that is already discoverable. That does not include the recently discovered Kitchen Lights and Cosmo fields, as well as other fields that are discovered but still under development. So these are the fields that are, I guess, for lack of a better word, behind pipe and able to be produced.
Plus probable.
Yes, proven plus probable. P1P plus 2P.
So follow up. As we shift from the North Slope, where obviously there's not really any near term concern about the supply, and now move to a basin that just a couple years ago we were scared we were going to have to do brownouts for, and now we're going to add some additional capacity. Plus, we just encouraged a couple days ago, we moved out of here, a bill to incentivize the opening of Agrium, which would add on to it. You feel comfortable with us going forward with investing a substantial amount of money in a project that has what lifespan? I do not want the South Central area crisis to turn into a Fairbanks area crisis when there's the opportunity to take the investment we have now and put it in the North Slope so that Fairbanks has that long-term supply.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the representative's questions, and they're astute and timely and germane. And they remain to be established as you move through the due diligence process and take a closer look. The gas supply team on the Interior Energy Project, which I head, is working with the Department of Natural Resources in developing our best judgment as to the available gas reserves. The indications are favorable, but that remains to be worked on in considerable detail. In particular, I would note I had a conversation with NSTAR, who has 134,000 customers in South Central. And their note was that their gas supply is firm through the first quarter of 2018, and they're in the market looking for gas from second quarter 2018 going forward. Obviously, the state of Alaska, in facilitating a solution to the Fairbanks situation, can't. Their 139,000 ratepayers are your 139,000 citizens. And so final judgment of the questions you're raising remains to be answered as we move forward through the process, including due diligence. But I do believe that the when you look at the data that's available from DNR, there's about a 400 I'm trying to make sure I get my measurement terms right. It's a 0.4 TCF increase in gas supply in the Cook Inlet since 2009. So that brownout situation has shifted, and there appears to be ample reserves. And, of course, when any kind of reserve evaluation, it depends on price point. So there's work to be done to completely answer your question, but the indications are favorable.
So then last follow-up, Mr. Chair. So then the last question would relate to, are we giving you authority to go forward no matter what, and you're going to make that decision on whether or not that's the appropriate direction forward, or does the legislature still have the ability to agree with you in essence with your decision that this is the right policy for the Cook Inlet Basin based on the legislation in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, I can jump in on that. If the member will look to the end version on page 7, lines 18 through 20, in the previous committee, some language was added that indicates that before the board can go forward and use any more of the tools, that is the ADA board, they actually have to approve a plan. And you can see on line 18 on page 7, that is an identified source of gas. So if in fact there was a proposal from the Cook Inlet, the board, as part of its due diligence, would have to deem that that gas availability is sure enough for a long enough period of time at a price point that would make the project work. We'd also have to run any proposal on the North Slope through that same matrix to decide. But it would be the ADA board's power to make that determination, just as any other project that ADA has given authorization to. They put it through a due diligence process.
Mr. Chair, we're not putting a time frame, though, and how long we expect the reserves to last. We're really throwing it on you. You guys get to make the decision.
That's correct.
It's out of our hands at this point.
That's correct.
Okay, we've done that before, by the way, with the gas line, Mr. Chair, where we've taken it out of our hands. I'm really concerned with the legislature losing our ability to control some of these policy discussions.
Gentlemen, are you going to be available tomorrow morning when we reconvene at 8:30 to answer additional questions?
Yes, sir.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and move to public testimony at this time. We'll see you in the morning to answer more questions.
Can I please clarify one point? You
quickly.
Mentioned, thank you. Quickly, you said one trillion cubic feet of gas. What's that based on?
That's DNR's evaluation. That's a February PowerPoint, and it's 1P plus 2P, proven plus probable.
How recent is that?
February 2015.
Okay. From DGGS, can I get that report? I'll get it. Thank you. Sir.
Okay. And
Mr. Chairman, just to wrap up one other point,
because
there are a couple of projects that are added in here, possible hydroelectric projects.
Correct.
When ADA does the due diligence on whether to loan out money for those projects, one of the components that is considered is whether, in fact, the proponent actually has a power sales agreement. For what length of time? At what cost? That's part of the due diligence. So the process that we'd be going through on the supply of natural gas for this project is very similar to any kind of hydro when ADA is empowered to make that decision. In fact, is there a sales agreement there that actually underpins the financing?
Okay, thank you. And we are going to move to public testimony at this time. We're going to move to... let's start on this page. Merrick Pierce in Fairbanks, and we are going to limit public testimony to 2 minutes, please. Mr. Pierce, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, please place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, we have one of the people here at the IO that has to get to another meeting, and I'd like to let her go ahead of me, and then I'll go second.
Maybe you're a little too close. It's breaking up a little bit, Merrick.
Mr. Chairman, if I'd like to have another person who has another meeting testify ahead of me.
Okay. Who would that be?
Patrice Lee.
Who?
Patrice Lee.
Patrice Lee, would you please place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you. Patrice Lee, 676 Hillcrest Drive, Fairbanks. I'm speaking on behalf of myself and also for Citizens for Clean Air. We'd like to thank Mr. Parody and the crew for representing and stating the severity of our air quality situation in the interior. As of May 1st, the finalized report will come out that indicates that we are the most polluted non-attainment area in the nation by twice as much. Bakersfield, California will run a distant second. I have two concerns regarding the version N of this bill. I want to thank you for the work that you've done on it since it came out a couple days ago. First, Section 8. I'm a bit concerned that that restricts our options for sources of gas. It could be a little more free market. Second, I'm concerned about the actual price or the buying price of Fairbanks natural gas. It seems quite high, and I wondered if anyone was working on, you know, if that was a final price or there was something more reasonable. The last thing I would like to say is that we have 100,000 people in the Fairbanks North Shore Borough, approximately, who depend on us getting this right and moving forward with gas or propane in a most expeditious manner. I'm concerned and hope that no one would believe that the restart of a fertilizer plant would be more important than 100,000 people in the interior. We need to tie our fortunes to Anchorage. We can be an asset to you to increase your market and your bargaining capacity, I believe, and it's a good idea for us to be connected, at least in theory, and have that option available to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Mr. Pierce, did you wish to testify now?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Good to speak with you and the members of the committee again. This afternoon, Mr. Chairman, I sent to your office via email.
Place yourself on the record, please, Merrick.
Merrick Pierce of Fairbanks.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. So this afternoon, I sent you via email some new research that came out in the British Medical Journal, which documents some of the significant health risks that are associated with high particulate levels, and that'll be available for you and all the members of the committee if you can get it added to the documents. But the conclusion of the study was that gaseous and particulate air pollutants have a marked and close temporal association with admissions to hospital for stroke or mortality from stroke, and it just adds to the pretty significant body of evidence that the air pollution here is very, very harmful to human health. Mr. Chairman, I'm very appreciative of the fact that the language that you have before you in version N has all the options available. I like the idea that you can look at propane. I like the idea that you can look at a pipeline. These might be part of a phased approach to fix this problem. Propane has a lot of advantages in that it doesn't, it stores very well. It's not expensive to produce. It's not expensive to store or transport like LNG. And I think, too, it's important as you look at our solution that, you know, what do we do if we have $30 oil? That is a real possibility. If we have $30 oil, the whole question in this community and the conversions that need to occur are going to be imperiled if we don't bring the energy here at the lowest possible cost. And I just open up with one other comment that, you know, we had a delegation from Japan visit here at the interior last fall, and one of the comments from one of the visitors was, if you don't have affordable energy, you don't have industry, and if you don't have industry, you don't have jobs. And so beyond just having space heating, you know, if we can really bring the cost of energy here to the interior at a really low price, we have the very real prospect of attracting industry here. And that, I think, can help mitigate what's happening with the state economy at large with the loss of government jobs. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude by saying that I'm a little troubled by Section 8, which sort of takes a tool out of the toolbox. It keeps keeps ADA from getting into a place where they could buy gas reserves or get a working interest gas lease. You know, discussions I've had with some of the developers in the Cook Inlet, it could be a real powerful tool. It could reduce the cost to deliver gas to Fairbanks by a couple bucks, and it can make the difference between a project working or not working. Happy to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. Thank you very much. Next, from Fairbanks, we have Pamela Throop. Pamela, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Representative Thompson. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I bring a little
place
different
place yourself on the record, please.
Oh, I'm Pamela Troop from Fairbanks.
Go ahead.
I bring a different perspective to this, I think. I am a commercial real estate broker. For the last 20 years, I've done exclusive commercial real estate sales. I deal exclusively every day with investors and business owners to assist them in buying or selling their properties or businesses. I handle a major portion of the leases and commercial transaction in Fairbanks. My company does. It gives me that unique perspective. When talking to people who want to locate here and to businesses that are here, their biggest concern is the cost of doing business here, which is directly related to utilities. So we haven't had the expansion that you've had, that people have had in Anchorage. I support the changes in this bill. I oppose number 8 that says that we have to buy gas from anywhere but Cook Inlet. Someone made a suggestion to me at one point that if we have a line coming from Anchorage that delivers gas, and then eventually we get a pipeline from the North Slope, that someday those two could be connected so that the gas from the North Slope could then flow to Anchorage, which would alleviate those who are concerned about natural gas running out in the Cook Inlet area. I also support the ADA and IPE or IEP to be able to look at any source of any kind of energy for Fairbanks. It is absolutely the thing that's going to cause Fairbanks to continue to contract and to become a shadow of what I think it once was.
Okay, thank you very much, Pamela. Next in Fairbanks, we have Jim Dodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, place yourself on the record, and we'll hear from you, Mr. Dodson.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Place yourself on the record, and go ahead.
This is Jim Dodson. I'm president of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. Thank you and the committee for an opportunity to talk. I'm here today to speak in favor of committee substitute and for House Bill 105. I had the opportunity to sit next to Governor Parnell when he came to Fairbanks and offered to support the Fairbanks community with his energy project. Obviously, affordable energy is vital to commerce in Fairbanks, Alaska, but also clean air is vital to the health of our children and the people living in Fairbanks. It is important that we recognize Governor Parnell's desire to help move this project forward because of the need to continue to build a state, not just communities, but build a state all across Alaska. Very few communities today have affordable energy. Fairbanks is one of them. We have an opportunity here to build a roadmap of how to bring affordable energy to all of the state of Alaska and create the lifestyle we are guaranteed under statehood. I urge the legislature to continue to move forward to bring this energy project to fruition for the interior and ultimately for all of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dodson. Next we have in Fairbanks, Jomo Stewart.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jomo Stewart. I'm the Energy Project Manager for the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation and obviously a resident of Fairbanks, Alaska. And I simply wanted to associate myself with the comments of my boss, Jim Dodson. I do obviously believe it went on record that I did have some concerns with the CS that came out of the House Resources Committee, but they have been substantively mitigated by the CS that is now before you, and so I hope that you will move expeditiously to move it through the process so that we can move along with the project. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stewart. Next, we have Lisa Herbert in Fairbanks, the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. Lisa, place yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Rep. Thompson and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Herbert, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce here in town. Thanks for taking comment this afternoon on House Bill 105. It's really no secret that reducing the high cost of energy has been and continues to be our chamber's number one critical priority. I think I might be preaching to the choir about the need for affordable energy, but I'm compelled to repeat it because our community has been waiting anxiously for natural gas for many, many years. I'm representing about 700 businesses here in the interior and our entire community. Last week, we transmitted a letter to your committee regarding our concern with the amendments made to the bill by House Resources, and we support the substitute that's before you today, as it does eliminate the requirements and prohibitions that would be placed on ADA. HB 105 provides optionality for ADA to ensure a successful interior energy project, and the need for the bill is now. ADA must be able to proceed with the process of selecting a partner and a gas supply. The changes in House Resources last week are in direct conflict with the stated IEP goals of getting gas to as many people in the interior as possible, as affordable as possible, and as quickly as possible, the same goals that were supported by the legislature through passage of legislation in previous sessions. We encourage the legislature to remain committed to and supportive of those stated goals, and we urge you to pass HB 105 as amended. I thank you for your time today, thank you for your service to our state, and thank you for supporting affordable energy for the interior.
Thank you, Ms. Herbert, very much. Next we have in Fairbanks, Derek Miller. Derek, place yourself on the record. We'll hear your testimony.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I promise I'll be brief. For the record, my name is Derek Miller, 1225 Trianon Drive, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a homeowner and pay in full my semi-annual fuel oil bills to my local fuel distributor. I also do the same with the rental property unit, and I pay my monthly electric bill on time every time. I was born and raised in Fairbanks and intend on remaining here to work and raise my young family. I previously spent time as a legislative aide to represent Mike Kelly, so I'm familiar with the sacrifice each of you make serving in the legislature. And for the past 5 years, I've worked in various capacities at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and currently serve as the chair of the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce Government Relations Committee. First off, thanks again for your dedicated service to the state, particularly as it relates to addressing the high cost of energy in the interior by passing SB 23 in 2013, also known as the Interior Energy Project. The three stated goals of the IEP, as stated in the presentation and by Lisa previously, are to bring affordable natural gas to the interior, to the greatest number of interior residents and businesses as possible, and to the greatest and as rapidly as possible. With all due respect to the House Resources Committee, their amendments do not support these stated goals and are in direct conflict with them. The IEP project plan and corresponding funding have already been approved by the legislature. Requiring additional legislative approval at this time is redundant, unnecessary, and puts the whole project at risk. The original intent behind HB 105 is relatively simple and narrow in scope. Allow ADA the ability to finance energy projects in the state, period, without restriction to just the North Slope. In closing, you have terribly difficult issues to wrestle with this session, the biggest being how to address the $3.5 to $4 billion budget deficit. I do not envy you and the difficult decisions you will have to make in the coming days and in the foreseeable future. That being said, the issue before you this afternoon is not terribly difficult. I appreciate the concerns raised by your Anchorage colleagues about the Cook Inlet supply, but as a lifetime resident of the interior, I encourage the committee to remove or amend the changes made by the House Resources Committee and allow ADA to proceed with due diligence in selecting a project partner and gas supply and pass the bill out of committee. I'll defer to your better judgment, Mr. Chairman, the judgment of the members of your committee and the judgment of the administrative officials presenting the bill on whether or not this House CS accomplishes that. However, if your very capable staff, Jane Pearson, has anything to do with it, I'm sure this bill is absolutely impeccable. So thank you for your dedicated service to the state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. Also online, we have Mayor Luke Hopkins from Fairbanks. Mayor Hopkins, if you place yourself on the record, we'll hear your testimony. We're giving everybody 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you very much, Representative Thompson. This is Mayor Luke Hopkins, Fairbanks North Star Borough. I would certainly echo many of the statements that have been made on the House Committee substitute. The issues, of course, that I've raised, I think most of you received the letter today. Sorry it took delay. But the issues that House Resource made on with amendments to HB 105 are unacceptable, and certainly hope that the House Committee substitute on HB 105 certainly performs most or all of the issues that the three mayors had concern with, and that the issues with Ada being able to move forward without the restrictions of Mother May I be what is needed for our community. I was not able to speak before House Resources, but I can tell you that I had a call with EPA, and we certainly need to stay on track for what we're trying to do to resolve our air quality, but the biggest issues is what we're trying to do for our economy and for our residents with getting low-cost energy here as soon as possible at the lowest cost. Thank you very much. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mayor Hopkins. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 105? Seeing none, is anyone else online? All right, seeing no further testimony on House Bill 105, we'll close public testimony for now. This will bring back House Bill 105 before the committee for discussion. We are going to take that discussion up and take amendments tomorrow morning at 8:30 a.m. Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When they come back tomorrow, they could bring, we had some questions on gas and Cook Inlet. First of all, I just want to remind people that's not your gas, it's our gas, the entire state, for those who live in Anchorage. But I know we've given a lot of tax credits, subsidies, and things to Cook Inlet, and I think that would be important for this group to understand that the state of Alaska has been in the energy business for a long time, and this is not the first time. Thank you.
Senator Sadler, quickly.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, did you close public testimony or did you suspend
it? Yes, I did close public testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. We will bring this back up tomorrow morning at 8:30. And, gentlemen, will you be here tomorrow morning at 8:30? I appreciate it very much. And we'll have some more questions for you, and we'll bring this back before committee discussion. And also tomorrow we'll be taking amendments following that. So, excuse me, gentlemen and ladies. We can't hear with everybody talking at once. Tomorrow morning, Tuesday, April 14th, 8:30 a.m., we will restart the conversation on House Bill 105 and also talk on previously heard bills or scheduled. And then tomorrow at 1:30 p.m., House Bill 148/HB 190, discussion on State of Alaska single audit recommendations from the Department of Health and Social Services. Chris Curtis, Legislative Audit, will be here. And then tomorrow night at 6 p.m., we will have public testimony on SB 26, which is the capital budget. And with that, at 3:50 p.m., we are adjourned.